This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Joy of Text, a monthly podcast about Judaism and sexuality. For our season 3 finale, we get a little adventurous with a listener question about kink.
Rope bondage. So, we don't make knots on Shabbos.
Is it okay to have kinky sex at all? Is it okay to have power imbalance sex?
Then we'll talk with the executive director of Mayim Chaim, Carrie Bornstein, and her husband Jamie Bornstein about Carrie's experience serving as a surrogate.
These people are now parents because of me, and the entire process was among the most meaningful things I've ever done in my life.
And of course, the final word. Stay tuned for The Joy of Text Season 3 finale after this quick word from our sponsor.
What was the last Shabbat table conversation that got you excited? Who was the last person to change your mind? When was the last time a Facebook post just didn't feel like the right medium for expressing your thoughts and feelings? If you have answers to these questions, and I know you do, then it's time to write for Jofa's blog at The Jewish Week. At Jofa's blog, we believe in catalyzing change in the Jewish community by giving voice to its members and inspiring conversations one blog post at a time. Bring your voice into the collective conversation and submit your piece today. For more information, email shira@jofa.org.
Welcome to The Joy of Text. I'm Rebecca Honig-Friedman. I'm here with Rabbi Dov Linzer, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Chovavei Torah Rabbinical School, and Dr. Batsheva Marcus, Clinical Director at Maze Women's Health and President of Jofa. We have a really adventurous episode today. Later on, we'll talk with Carrie and Jamie Bornstein about their experience with surrogacy. But first, we'll delve into our listener question. We have a disclaimer at the beginning of each episode saying that this podcast contains explicit material, but we just want listeners to know that this episode will actually be a little more explicit than usual. So
more explicit than usual?
More explicit than usual.
This episode deals with kink, and if that makes you uncomfortable or that really makes you uncomfortable having your kids listen to it, you should just know that before we delve into it.
Okay, so that said, consider yourself forewarned, and here's the question. My wife and I are a modern Orthodox couple who have been happily married for over 25 years. We are and have throughout our marriage always been a bit kinky. Much of the time we have to play is on Shabbat or Yom Tov. Which brings me to the questions we would love to hear you address on your podcast. Assume for the rest of the questions that all of these activities are safe, sane, and consensual.
Let me just clarify two things that they just said. So one is when people are doing like BDSM or bondage domination sexual activity, they usually call it playing. And that's why when the listener wrote in, the only time we have to play is on Shabbat. And the other piece was that there was a disclaimer, assume that it's all sane, safe, and consensual, because everybody on this podcast would agree that any kind of power play sex, sex that involves tying somebody up, hitting, you know, slapping, whatever, that can only be done when there is consent from both parties. Both parties are equally into it, because bondage domination sex, when there isn't consent, is abuse. And the difference between abusive sex and sex where they're playing with this type of sex is when there's mutual consent and everything is safe. Okay, I just needed to give you those explanations for our listeners.
Thanks for the clarifications. So they have a bunch of questions here. I'll just read through them quickly and we'll try to touch on most of them. Can you use coconut oil as a lubricant on Shabbat? Coconut oil is usually a solid at room temperature, but will become liquid when put on the skin. Is this a problem on Shabbat or Yom Tov? Can you do rope bondage on Shabbat or Yom Tov? Is it an issue that the rope may leave a mark? What types of knots can be used? Are there any issues to be aware of in use of toys on Yom Tov or Shabbat as sex toys? Is spanking permitted? What about using an implement such as a paddle or cane? And finally, when you have sex in the sukkah for the first time once you coat, should you say Shehechianu and Leishi Vesukah?
So I have to laugh because we get lots and lots of questions, and we got this question. Our first reaction was like, somebody's kidding, they're yanking our chains. But then We
especially
talked about
with it, that sukkah question.
Especially with the sukkah question, exactly. But then we decided, you know, even if somebody is sort of asking this question a little bit tongue-in-cheek, they're legitimate questions. There may be listeners who really want to understand this stuff. And so we're going to answer it as if they're serious questions. And if you are the person who wrote it in and you were kind of joking around, we hope you get a kick out of it.
And I should say that what I like about the questions is that they really show that somebody can be, you know, exploring sexually or adventurous, maybe I should say, and at the same time, that's not at all a contradiction to real seriousness about details of halacha. And, you know, and the fact that you're asking questions about technicalities of Shabbat is terrific. Yeah.
And so I need to give a little credit here to my husband, because at one point I mentioned to him that these questions had come in and that we didn't think that the person necessarily meant them seriously. And he said, you know, you're kind of going against everything you always say, because, you know, there's no reason they shouldn't be interested in these questions. There's halachic issues here. And so I was like, okay, you're right. I was, you know, tzadak mi meni, and we decided to address these questions.
And I should actually say there's precedent in the Gemara, you know, because the, as many yeshiva boys know who've learned Masechet Ketuvot, one of the opening discussions in that tractate is about, can you have intercourse for the first time on Shabbat? Is the first intercourse, which breaks the hymen, like making a wound or like creating something? And the Gemara gets into all these nice detailed discussions, which again, men talking about women's bodies and so on. The fact that it's a question about what can you do sexually on Shabbat, you know, is right there. So the Gemara deals with these types of issues.
And these questions basically we're saying are in the mode, very much the mode of the Gemara. So, okay.
There you go.
Right. And they're like basically verbatim from the Talmud. Right?
Okay, so tell us about the coconut oil.
Okay, so the coconut oil. So it actually is true that the general practice is that you don't take something that's like a solid and smooth it over skin or smooth it over a surface. That's considered a type of mimareach, smoothing. That's why some people don't brush their teeth on Shabbat or use toothpaste, because they're concerned that it's sort of like smoothing the toothpaste over the skin. So there's some discussion.
They use Shabbos toothpaste, just to
excellent.
Clarify, yeah.
In Israel, they've got the liquid toothpaste, which is really very good.
Terrible, but okay.
Anyway, you know, there is questions about this. Like, are you really trying to create a smooth surface? Are you really just trying to apply it, you know, all over the place? You're not really trying to, like, create it's not like smoothing a piece of leather where you're trying to create a smooth product at the end. But nevertheless, that is the general practice. But I don't think that has to be a problem here, because you can just apply it in, like, dabs. You don't have to like smooth it out, and then you sort of, you know, let the sexual activity sort of take care of that. You know, I assume we're talking about, well,
I want to just say, so in case anybody is confused about this, a lot of people use coconut oil as a lubricant. It's a great lubricant because it starts out as a solid and it rubs on and it's natural and it's cheap and it doesn't stain things. So that's why people are asking about coconut oil.
There's also usually a liquid at the top.
If you hold it in your hand, like sometimes it will liquefy because of the heat of the hand.
If you just hold it in your hand, it will liquefy.
You can certainly just do that and hold it in your hand and wait for it to liquefy. You know, it's interesting. You're not allowed to like take ice and crush it and make it into water, because that's like creating a change of state. But you are allowed to take ice and put it in a cup and let it melt, or even put the cup in the sun
so
and let
more
it
of
melt.
A passive
so
thing.
It's passive. So you can certainly take this in your hand, let it liquefy. The other issue about smearing it might have to do with the question that it's technically coconut oil can also be used as a type of a food product, and this might not be applicable to food products. So, but nevertheless, I would sort of advise more dabbing it or just waiting for it to liquefy.
Okay. And, what about rope bondage?
Rope bondage. So we don't make knots on Shabbos. There's a whole question about what constitutes a biblical knot. Certainly it has to be something that's permanent. Also, how long do you define permanent as?
Does it matter what you're using? Because I will say that a lot of people, when they're doing this kind of bondage stuff, are often using like ties.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, whole questions become about like even, you know, like tie silk. Your shoelaces, any type of thing could be making a knot.
But silk unties really easily. So,
oh,
I don't
so
know
that's
that,
the
like
issue. So I'm going to get to that. So the two criteria
like
for
neckties.
Something to be a biblical
yes,
problem
sorry, yeah.
of Shabbos, right, is permanent. And according to some, it also would have to be considered a professional knot, although that's debated. So rabbinically,
a professional knot, I mean, like if you're a
like
sailor.
Like a sailor's
and
knot, exactly. One of those knots that you learned in the Boy Scouts or whatever. You got to look at a book to figure out how to make them. Anyway, so rabbinically, if it's neither a professional knot nor permanent, it's permissible. And for Ashkenazim, not permanent means that it's plan on undoing it within the day, which I certainly hope is the case. And also, it should also be in a type of a context where it's normal to not leave it for more than a day. Types of things which are, you know, even if something is normally made for longer, but you're intending to undo it, then that could be a problem. So certainly, I think that if it's in that type of a context, you know, if you do it in a way that's easy to pull and undo, and it doesn't require, it didn't get so tight that now you got to, like, you know, spend time yanking it apart and so on. I mean, do people usually use like a type of a slip knot or?
No, I think when people are kind of playing, they're using like neckties and they're.
What are you doing? Like a double knot?
Yeah. Or one knot even. Yeah. Not a Windsor, but like even like a, what do you call a shoelace knot where you have the little
loop.
Because you don't want something you can't pull out if the person wants you to stop.
So anything that's done like a shoelace or a single knot, I would say the double knot that in the process also gets really tight and then becomes hard to undo, that would be a problem. But anything like that's, you know, you easily undo and it's made to, you know, obviously you're not intending to leave
you
it for
a long
time.
You want enough knots so that the person can like not slip out totally because then it would take the fun away. The idea is that you're pretending at least to be tying the
you
person
You can make
off.
Things that are not knots on Shabbat and that really stay. I have to just use this as an opportunity to say how I solve the problem with garbage bags on Shabbat. Because, you know,
please
you got
tell
your,
us how you solve the garbage
I will tell you because everybody, you got your garbage bag. And so do you use the twist ties? But then if you break off the twist ties, is that like making a kli, and when you twist them, is that like making a knot? Anyway, here's what I do, is I take the garbage bag, you know, I sort of take the top and I like spin the garbage bag around. So like the top sort of handle, you know, the top of the bag becomes sort of like a string like type of thing. And then I just make a tight slip knot like you would make for.
Oh, so that's usually what I do too.
Really? Look at that. We both figured it out.
But even during
it totally
the
stays tight. You throw it out. It doesn't get undone. But if you wanted to, you just would have to yank it and the whole thing would come out. So you can make tight knots that will
so
stay.
So I think that's exactly the kind of knots that people would use.
Yeah.
And then the person asked about the mark on the arm also.
Right. You could also, by the way, you know, handcuffs are not a problem at all. That's just doing a lock, like locking something.
Oh, that's fascinating.
You can lock a door.
They sell really inexpensive, like fur-covered handcuffs, just telling you for exactly this purpose.
There you go.
If it leaves a mark.
Oh, if it leaves a mark. So, you know, there is an issue of making marks on Shabbat, but that's like intentionally doing so. This is sort of like more like, are you allowed to walk in the snow because the bottom of your shoes are going to make a mark, you know? And the answer is like,
it's unintentional. It's
unintentional.
Secondary.
It's not a normal way of doing it. You know, you don't want, you know, you have no interest in it being done. It's not permanent. So clearly this would not be a problem, you know, from that perspective.
Right. So is spanking permitted?
And so that's not a Shabbos question.
Why would spanking
so
not
I think
be
the question would be about,
you know,
they were concerned about on Shabbat, like leaves a mark.
Well,
but that's the mark issue, but
I would broaden the question too. Yes.
Well, yeah, but you know what? I feel like we should have prefaced this whole discussion with, is it okay to have kinky sex at all? Is it okay to have power imbalance sex? Which I think we did address in another episode, but I feel like we should give it a sentence or two here about how sex, which two people want, even if it's looks like, just because it's like margarine, right? And you're eating it with meat. Even though it looks like butter, it isn't buttered, right? In other words, it's really clear that you can't have abusive sex, that that halacha does not allow you to have abusive sex. But when something sort of pretends to be abusive or looks like abusive, and that's what I'd say, that's like eating margarine with your steak. It's like, it looks like butter, but it isn't butter.
Right. And I think you should say again, and we've said it before, something about a safe word, because that's part of
this. Yeah. So just bottom line, if you're ever trying to do any kind of this, BDSM bondage domination play, you need to have a safe word, a word that you can use to communicate with your partner when you really want to stop the game. So, and you don't want that word to be stop, because for many couples, part of the fun is for, you know, one of the couples to say, no, stop. And the other person say, aha, I'm never stopping, you know? But if you really want the person to stop, you need a word to communicate that, like banana. So like, or orangutan, some word where you say like banana and the person says, okay, now what's going on? And you're like, I have to go to the bathroom and I didn't want to ruin this, you know?
Or it's no longer fun for me.
Right, exactly. Or this is not really fun for me, or I'm getting bored.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I would say that it goes back also to the statement in the Talmud that whatever, you know, a couple wants to do, they can do. And the Talmud really says as long as, again, it's consensual and it's and you're not taking advantage of one another.
Mutually pleasurable,
then the couple can do whatever they want.
We're going to get pushback. I mean, I just want to say we are going to get pushback because people are going to say, well, it's not the spirit of the law. Maybe the letter of the law, but it's not the spirit of the law. And I would argue that it is the spirit of the law. If you, two people want to try this because it's fun and they're married and, you know, both are really into it, then I think it's, yes, it is the spirit of the law. Yeah. I'm already arguing back to the.
Right. But that's. So about the spanking.
So I think the issue about the spanking, you know, there is a halacha that says that you're not allowed to lift your hand up against a fellow person. And that if you, you know, if you hit somebody, you transgress a negative prohibition of lo yosif lahakoto, which is said about administering lashes. You can't give somebody an additional lash that they didn't in the court. You know, the court administered punishment if they didn't deserve it, from which the rabbis generalize that it's biblically prohibited to hit another person. But. And the big but is that that's all when it is done in a context. The phrase the Rambam uses is if it's derech nitzayon, or another version of that text is derech bizayon. So nitzayon is in the context of fighting, and bizayon is in like a shaming, degrading. And there are many, like, look, this is not the time for this conversation, but the Talmud had no problem with corporal punishment, with, you know, parents spanking their kids, their children, with rabbis, you know, with teachers hitting their children. I mean, we know that that happened, you know, for thousands of years.
We don't advocate
we
it.
We do not no, advocate
we,
it.
We but think it is very, very wrong.
Yes. Okay. Thank you all for that clarification. But it was not, certainly not seen as a violation of this prohibition, because the large context is that if it is seen as, which that was, again, not advocating it, but something as constructive, or if it's seen as something that has been desired, asked, like if somebody asks to be hit, not wounded, that's like a different story in terms of drawing blood, but just wants to be hit or something, then it's not, then everybody agrees that there's no violation.
And in terms of leaving marks or drawing blood, like, would that make a difference?
Yeah, drawing blood is more complicated in halacha. That drawing blood is more, is less contextual. Although even there, you can do surgery, you know, when it's clearly for a beneficial purpose.
So I hear it's interesting. I feel like when you're talking about drawing blood, now I'm not even talking about the context of Shabbat. I'm just talking about it.
Yeah, we're talking about in general.
In general, drawing blood. If you do anything that actually does harm to the body, I sort of start having questions about that. From the sex therapist.
We're
position.
Not disagreeing. I was saying the same thing. But
oh,
when you're
fine.
Actually
okay.
drawing blood, it is more problematic halachically. If it's slapping and so on leaves a mark, then as long as somebody's, you know, they're having fun. Rav Moshe speaks about derech, like if somebody asks for it, then it's not, and it's essentially derech schok is the phrase Rav Moshe. He wasn't talking about this context.
Right, he was saying, right.
But he was talking
he was
about
saying,
that
like,
if somebody wants
this, punch
somebody
me.
Punch me or whatever, that's allowed. So, yes, but if it actually right. leads to drawing blood, that's a different story.
Or like right. a really bad bruise.
Yeah, I mean, right. We could, there are lines, yes. Mm.
Dr. Marcus, can you talk a little bit more about why these kinds of things are attractive to people?
So I don't love to talk about why these things are fun for people. Everybody is just different and people have very different erotic maps. I think there is something about like letting go and being sort of taken by somebody else, which is often very appealing.
Mm-hmm. And the fantasy aspect of it.
In the fantasy aspect, and this is a role playing, basically. This is a fantasy. There are some people who, you know, have sort of, you know, violent fantasies for reasons I don't know. And they're not necessarily linked to abuse. I don't think people should jump to the assumption that people were abused or something terrible happened in their past. Sometimes that's true, but more often than it's not the case. People just like different things. And sex and power have for always been linked together for eons and eons and eons. And this is not so unusual. I mean, 50 Shades of Grey was an incredibly popular book for a reason, right? It really spoke to many, 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 for sure women and probably men as well. But in this, those books were written for women. So I'm not gonna hazard a guess beyond that. I'm just gonna say that there's a lot of people who are really into this kind of play.
All right, thanks. Well, it was definitely.
Oh, we didn't do the sukkah question.
Oh, right. So,
what's the sukkah question?
Do you say Shachrianu and Leishev Basukah?
Yeah, so that's why I think it's totally a joke, because the practice is that we only say a bracha of Leishev Basukah when we eat. According to the Talmud, actually, sleeping is more the classic act of living in a sukkah than eating.
Right.
Is.
People don't make a bracha when they sleep in a sukkah.
People do not make a bracha when they eat and sleep in a sukkah, only when they eat. The Gemara never, of course, speaks about sex in the sukkah. It's actually interesting that the Ramah in justifying the practice in Ashkenaz, why we don't sleep in a sukkah, even though according to the Talmud, it's primary. And of course, a lot of that has to do with geographically, you know, it's not as temperate in France or Germany
or
safe as it is in Israel. It's beautiful in Israel to sleep in a sukkah. Anyway, he says, well, since you're supposed to live in a sukkah as you live in your house, and that would require basically husband and wife to be sleeping together in a sukkah. I don't remember if he speaks about sex. I don't think so. But anyway, he says, well, that's not going to happen because the wife isn't going to agree. So that's why the men don't have to sleep in the sukkah either. So anyway, but you would not be making brachas around that.
Would it be permissible though?
You know,
would it be permissible what?
To have sex in the sukkah?
Why would it not be permissible?
I don't know.
Look, it's an interesting question.
Why would it not?
Technically, of course, it's permissible, but sort of at a
depends where your sukkah is. If you have a sukkah,
No. Yes. Of course, assuming privacy and assuming all of that.
Right.
No, the issue is that at a sort of at a religious level, you know, the sukkah is, there's a lot already in the Talmud that the sukkah not only sort of evokes, you know, the Sukkot they dwelled in the wilderness, but also the heavenly clouds, that the Gemara actually says, like, God's name is, like, connected to the Schach. The Schach is like sort of, you know, the heavenly clouds and God's presence. So there's a lot, you know, it's
so
stuff
what?
That I could understand that could get people a little weirded out.
Really?
Yeah.
You could see it as sanctifying the sukkah.
There
or,
you go.
Or
I think
not.
It depends on your attitude.
That's so funny. That never even occurred to me. I assumed people don't have sex with the sukkah because usually it's a little bit of a public place. But if you had a sukkah right off your bedroom on a little balcony.
Right.
I
think it depends on how.
People have sukkah have sex on the beach. I don't know.
I think it depends on how. I'll tell you, there's an interesting Chafetz Chaim.
I feel like the Chafetz Chaim has come up on every single podcast.
Just a recent, just one before. Anyway, in the Mishnah Berurah, he speaks about, and it's terrible, you know, people are sitting in the sukkah and they're talking Lashon Hara. So, of course, it's always forbidden to talk Lashon Hara, but to talk Lashon Hara in the sukkah. You know, so right. There is this sense of almost like directly in God's presence that some people attach with this idea of the sukkah. So I can understand that could be a little weird for people, but I don't think that's a
Well, either way, you're not making a bracha.
You're not making a bracha.
Okay. Great. Well, this was definitely an adventurous conversation. We're going to be back in just a minute with Carrie and Jamie Bornstein after this word from our sponsor.
At Mays Health, we know that if you're having sexual problems, it can have a significant impact on your life and on your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it's important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Mays is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you're a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there is no solution. Visit us at www.mayshealth.com.
We're back with our guests for this episode. We're here with Carrie Bornstein and her husband, Jamie Bornstein. Carrie is the executive director of Mayim Chaim. Jamie is the senior director of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in North America. But the reason we have them on the podcast today is because Carrie was a surrogate. And we wanted to hear about her experience of that, and we wanted to hear about Jamie's experience with it. So thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so, yeah.
I just want to say how excited I am, because I was sort of following you along the way, because Carrie kept the blog during this whole thing. But it was such a cool story, and so I'm super excited that you're here.
Can you explain first, just for anyone who doesn't know, what is a surrogate?
Yes, so a surrogate is also known as being a gestational carrier, which is a phrase that I actually like better, because surrogate sort of refers to being a surrogate mother, and really despite the fact that I gave birth to a human who's in the world now, I have no relationship in terms of being a mother to that child. So I actually like the gestational carrier phrase better, which typically means that a woman would carry a baby for someone else that is typically not related to, you know, not genetically connected at all. There's traditional surrogacy, which is when the carrier is also using her own egg, which was not my situation. So I carried a baby for a couple who was, they tried unsuccessfully for 7 years to have their own baby. And this is what worked.
And why did you decide to do it?
So the reason was actually ended up being very connected to my work as the director of Mayim Chaim, and everything that I've seen there along the way. I've been on staff there since 2008 in different capacities in this community mikveh and education center. And my role there over time has been very connected to both the women and couples who, men too, who have come to use the mikveh for a variety of reasons. And many of them come around stages of fertility issues, whether it is following a miscarriage or just simply coming for nidah monthly and coming again and again and again and not wanting to be there and dealing with that pain. And that struck me a lot, seeing all of that and coming face to face with the challenges that people have faced, while at the same time having given birth to my own three children. And thank God, getting pregnant was extraordinarily easy for me for whatever reason. Staying pregnant was extraordinarily easy for whatever reason. It just was something that felt like it worked for my body. I like being pregnant. I never got to the stage where I was like, oh my God, I got this kid out of me. I'm done.
Oh, you never had that stage?
Never, ever. you know, it's like, I always felt this like, oh, it's almost over. I'm sad about that.
How was the experience of childbirth?
You know, it's not easy, but it's gone quick. My longest labor was under 4 hours. Wow. So, yeah, so it's like
you were made to have babies is what you're telling us.
Yes. Okay. And so I felt very much like this is something that just for whatever reason, it's a gift that I've been given. And then I would also see people coming to the mikveh in their 9th month of pregnancy or after they've adopted a child or had a baby from surrogacy and seeing the joy that they are experiencing and really feeling like, okay, I've got this empty uterus sitting here doing nothing, collecting dust, and let's put it to good use.
I'm going to give the concise version of what really happened.
Please do.
All those things are true. All those things are true. But people would ask Carrie consistently, as families do, who are in kind of a similar time of life, who are having children, they would say, how is your childbirth? How was your pregnancy? Just similar to what you're asking. And she would describe this very easy pregnancy for the most part and very easy for the most part delivery compared to a lot of stories that people have. And they would say to her, oh my God, you could totally be a surrogate. I wish you could carry, I would like to have another baby, but I don't want to do it. You should carry my baby. And it would always be a joke and we'd ha ha ha. And then Carrie would start talking about it. Like, maybe I should do that. And that would be happening at the same time as she was witnessing these events, sometimes very beautiful and sometimes very painful in Mayim Chaim. And I think those two conversations, which were really very separate from each other, what she saw at work and what she was just having socially, started to kind of coalesce into a little bit more of a, huh.
Maybe I should.
This
go.
Is a role I can
for
play
me,
in
it
the
was,
world.
It was a little bit like, you know, if you got that call that in the bone marrow registry that you were a potential match for someone, like I think most people who sign up for that registry would at least look into it and would say like, oh my God, I'm a match. I could help this person. I'm in a unique position to help. Let me look into it.
So why this baby this time? Like, in other words, what there must have been.
So I did joke about it forever. And then we were on a car ride down to New York for Erev Sukkot, you know, a couple of years ago when I said, like, you know what? I wonder if I actually, no, I'm probably too old. I'm probably too this, too that. And I said, let me just look into it.
So you were 38 or 39?
So I was 39 when I delivered and I was 36. 7 when I started thinking about the process.
And you thought you might be too old, but you weren't, obviously.
Right, okay. Right. Because I didn't know anything about how it worked, and I just started Googling, and ended up seeing like, I'm not too old. So you're telling me
I always assumed that somebody came to you and asked.
No.
Wow. So
how did the process, can you tell us briefly how the process
how went? I got to the, So I just started looking into it on my own. I made the decision pretty early on that if I was going to do this, I actually didn't want to do it for somebody that I knew. I was just too worried that with, like, this is an incredibly intense relationship and thing to go through and any number of complications that can come up. And I didn't want to risk dealing with any kind of personal friendship, you know, loss or anything. And other people feel the exact opposite. They definitely want to do it for somebody that they know. So I ended up going through an agency and was matched with a couple with this couple. We had to sort of interview. We had like a, you know, a Skype supervised date, basically, where we met each other. And I'm jumping over a lot of details here, but we ended up getting matched together. And these people really at this point, there were a lot of ups and downs. It was rocky at different points. And they feel like family at this point.
And Jamie, I want to ask you in a minute about your experience with this, but it was a Jewish couple.
Yes. Right?
And that was something that was important to you.
Yeah. There were a number of things that I wanted to, that I felt like very early on when I saw just on paper, I could do this. I felt like, you know, medically, I got to check in with my doctor and say, like, does she, you know, does my OB think that this is a crazy idea? Does she think it's a good idea? So that was one of the first things that I needed to do for myself. I wanted to check in with a rabbi to say, like, can Jews do this? Do Jews, like, how would this work? And so for a number of reasons, I wanted to do this specifically for a Jewish individual or couple.
So what was it like to be pregnant for 9 months with a baby that you weren't going to keep?
Glorious. Who wants to keep another child? I mean, oh my God. Like, you know, I mean, lots of people do for lots of reasons, but I, you know, we were so clear on being done with having our own children. There was no part of me that wanted a fourth child. And you know, yes, there's also a physical connection and just what that's like. I have to say, I don't know why, but even with my own kids, I never felt like I developed a connection with them before they were born. Like, I mean, maybe it's because we never knew the gender before any of our kids were born. We never picked out names until after they were born.
But you never, during the entire 9 months, you never stopped and thought to yourself, oh, maybe I should keep this baby.
No. Oh, God, no.
And I'm sure you had signed many contracts saying you would not keep
it. Oh, like in so many different ways. Yes. But it was like, oh, my God, I don't even have to take this home. This is the best.
You know? So, Jamie, what was this like for you to have your wife be pregnant with another, not exactly another man's child, another couple's child?
I was never the cheerleader behind this venture. Carrie would always say it, and I would always say, "You're crazy. We're gonna go through pregnancy again." As wonderful as Carrie does while pregnant, it's still the first trimester. Is still the first trimester, and my experience, each child that we had already when Carrie was pregnant, you know, the second pregnancy was harder than the first for me, obviously, because I can't. There are more people to care for. You have to care for your wife when she's pregnant. She's not at her 100%. And so the thought of going through that with three children while she was the executive director of an organization and I was working, you know, full time in my own job was very daunting. I had a lot of trouble with the idea conceptually. But what I will say is once you meet a family and start talking to them and hearing their story, it can be hard and also something that you can't say no to.
Despite Jamie's hesitations and the fact that he doesn't call himself a cheerleader, was
incredibly supportive and was a cheerleader in even though he won't say it. And just how important that is, that I do think that this is something that if somebody's going to consider doing it, that their partner is totally on board, because it's a huge thing. And he was much more supportive than he's letting on.
It's hard not to be in awe of your wife, even if you are, scared of the complexities of the scenario.
How did your kids deal with this? Did it weird them out? How about people in the community?
Our kids were, I got a couple children's books to explain how things work. My four-year-old now.
My mommy is a surrogate. What does this mean?
Basically.
A gestational carrier.
There you go. Our four-year-old still reads the What Makes a Baby book and walks around saying so you have sperm, I have sperm. Do I have a year? He wants to breastfeed other babies now. He's very keyed into all this. He's fascinated by it.
His teachers are thrilled.
We explained it to them that there is this couple who actually visited us the prior summer. And so, remember this couple that brought you all the presents that came to visit? Oh yeah. Yeah. We love
that. Smart move on their part.
Right. Yeah. Totally. We said that they've been trying to have their own baby the entire time. Our son was 7 at that point. The entire time Dovi has been alive, they've been trying to have their own baby and they haven't been able to. And so what they're going to do is they're going to give us, we taught them what an embryo is. They're going to let us borrow an embryo, and I'm going to take care of that until it's ready to become a baby and come out into the world. And then we're going to give it back to them.
The children was the easiest part, because the entire world is crazy to a kid. Every time they walk around the corner, there's something else crazy they haven't seen before. So if you behave to them as if this is normal, they kind of absorb it and accept it as normal, They ask a few questions. The oldest one, who's almost 11, would ask more questions, obviously.
Yeah, they just rolled with it, and they had the language and thought it was kind of cool and interesting. And, the rest of the community, I by and large, I think partly, especially because I kept this blog, I felt like everyone around me were just these incredible cheerleaders in a really wonderful, extraordinary way. There were a couple people who just kind of didn't know what to do with it, seemed to have trouble wrapping their brain around it. One person who said something negative to me along the way. That's really it.
Was it hard giving up that baby after she was born?
Giving back.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think I think that's actually a nuance.
Yes.
I think that language is important, because
you're right.
There was no sense of giving up. It's
right.
Oh my God, these people are now parents because of me. And there's a human in the world because of me. That was so incredibly powerful. And the entire process was among the most meaningful things I've ever done in my life, without question. And filled me up in such an important way. I think particularly being the executive director of an organization, I work extraordinarily hard. I pour my whole self into this place. And much of my work is very intangible. It's hard to know, did that thing happen because I had an impact, or it's just that's the way the stars aligned, or somebody else was really on the ground there. And this was a very concrete, I did that, very clear way of feeling okay, here's my efforts and I have something to show for it. And that felt very good.
Their disposition towards us made it much easier as well, though, because they, there are stories, we've heard them. You hear a lot of stories as you're going through the process of women who give birth, the baby is handed over to the parents and that's it. And they never really they don't communicate after that. And this was, we were very much in the hospital for several days with them, and they came to our house many times after the birth and wanted to be part of our lives.
Could not possibly say thank you enough.
We spent so much time holding this child. It was
right. I have, before you, life felt empty and meaningless, and now I have a purpose in life. And these crazy things that somebody could say, they could not.
Do you continue a relationship with them?
Yeah,
and
we're in touch. We're in touch by email, not as often now.
They live far away, I assume.
Yeah, they're overseas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they're not afraid that you might come once and present yourself as a mother. They haven't mentioned that.
No.
I could imagine a couple that would not want to maintain a relationship because they don't want that other person as part of the equation.
Yeah. And I've definitely seen that exist and seen, and listen, it's the whole, you know, fertility struggles are extraordinarily complicated. And I cannot pretend to know what it's like for someone to deal with that and what that means and how they relate to the world in that way. And I will say, and not that I'm saying that this can't happen with Jews, but it was another reason why I felt good about doing this for somebody who is Jewish, because it felt like we were already part of a community in some way, just that unspoken, we're all Jews here, we're all connected, we're all family in some extended way, more than, like, for me, that felt good, more than, like, some random stranger couple from wherever that, like, it felt like we were starting off from a
right.
I don't know if that's like
no,
that's right.
So can you share with us some of like the Jewish perspective on this, the rabbis you spoke to, what
yeah.
type of advice you got?
Yeah. So I checked in with an Orthodox rabbi that I have a connection with, and I didn't know if having any issues of mamzer would be a concern because I'm married, they're married, you know, all of that. But what the rabbi pointed out was there's no issue with mamzer because that's the product of a forbidden sexual encounter, and there is no sexual encounter here. This is, you know, going into an office building in Connecticut to, you know, get knocked up. So nothing sexy going on there. So that, you know, that was not an issue, but that, you know, halachically, I would be considered, you know, there's difference of opinion about whether it's the uterus, whether it's the egg, whether it's both that determines Jewish identity. So certainly my having a Jewish uterus would end up with having a Jewish baby. And so that you would want that baby to be raised in the Jewish world so that you didn't have an issue of a Jewish child out there running around, you know, not being in that environment.
It was important for you to do this for a Jewish couple.
Yes.
So you wouldn't have.
So the child would be Jewish regardless of whether you went by the egg or the uterus.
Exactly.
And even right. before that, Carrie had to get a letter from a Beit Din.
Right.
Affirming her Jewishness so that that was fully certified before we even spoke about anyone else who was involved in the creation.
So the Jewishness of the child would be confirmed and they wouldn't have to be
right. The couple
converted.
Was the couple Orthodox? So that's part of the complexity. They belong to an Orthodox shul. That is the world that they are a part of. They themselves are not, you know, observant in the typical Orthodox way. And they were actually concerned that they wouldn't be able to find a rabbi who would convert their baby. I mean, from where I sit, conversion is a totally like amazing celebratory act that part of me is like, oh, I want to convert my baby. It's so wonderful. Why wouldn't you want to do that? Like, what's the problem? And they were concerned, like, where are we going to find a Beit Din?
Observance wasn't exactly. high enough that would satisfy a rabbi.
Exactly.
An Orthodox rabbi.
So what,
Orthodox
right. rabbi. Right, right. And they, you know, like many people, didn't, you know, want to minimize the number of questions that might exist in the future. And so they felt like, if they're going to do this, it had to be a Jewish surrogate. And to the point that they actually said, you know what, if it doesn't work with you, we're just not going to have a kid. We're not going to have a baby.
Wow.
If you had done this younger, let's mm-hmm. say you had done this when you were 35,
yeah.
would you ever consider doing it a second time?
Looks at husband. You know, so
husband
here's the thing.
Remains quiet.
there were a number of things about this whole situation that were stressful and challenging and all of that. If those things did not happen and I was younger and all of that, I wouldn't be surprised. Like there was part of me throughout the process and after also that was like, okay, when can I do this again? How many people can
so
I do this
meaningful.
For? It was so meaningful. At the end of the day,
I'm crying
right.
as I'm listening to you. I'm like feeling like what other gift can you ever give anybody that is this equivalent?
I love the way you described the way you told it to your kids that you're taking care of this
right.
other couple's baby for a little right. while. And
call it extreme yeah. babysitting.
Yes, extreme babysitting.
Okay. I was going to ask if Rabbi Linzer, do you have anything to comment around the halacha of all of this?
Yeah. So the issue actually about the mamzer question is one which the actual halacha.
Basically, would the child be considered illegitimate?
Would be considered illegitimate a mamzer because of it's another man's baby. But, you know, that issue actually The halacha is very clear about it, although we should say that for some communities, some, I think, yeshivish and Hasidic communities, they're also against a married woman using another man's sperm to get pregnant because they consider that to be as if it's a mamzer, like not technically halachically. Everybody agrees technically halachically, it's only if with a forbidden act of intercourse. But the conceptually, for some communities, that's deeply disturbing. So that would even be for a couple struggling with infertility and the woman, you know, being using another man's sperm. So this would not be, would be the same as that. But certainly within our community, that's, I think, very widely accepted. And we don't feel that we have to sort of be concerned with that, which is not really a technical halachic issue. So that's certainly one thing to point out. Did you want to say something about
that,
Carrie?
Just that I'm so grateful that there are rabbis who are knowledgeable about the halakha and want to figure out a way to make this work. Because you think about this couple who said, if we can't have a Jewish baby, we are not going to have a baby at all. And what kind of position they're stuck with if they have rabbis, if they have rabbis telling them, no, you can't use a surrogate. Like, you can't have a Jewish surrogate or we won't convert your baby. They are stuck. Like, they are so stuck, and they're getting it at all sides with these roadblocks. And so just that I'm so grateful that, like, there are rabbis that are willing to look at the text and say, like, no, actually, that's not, you know, like, yes, we understand some people have concerns. However, So I think that that's really important.
And I understand already going back about 10 years, you know, Rav Amar consulted with Rav Avad Yosef because it's very hard apparently to find single women who want to do this, will do this, can do it. You know, I think the cost is much higher. And there are a lot of women in Israel who are looking for surrogates. And basically, you know, based on his ruling, I think a lot of it's now definitely an option in Israel for married women to be surrogates for another woman's child. Just one last thing that should be mentioned, you know, is that the idea of surrogacy in a way already is in the Torah. You know, Hagar is a surrogate for Sarah, right? You know, and, you know, Rachel, you know, Bilhah is a surrogate for Rachel.
And Zilpah.
Okay, and Zilpah, right? I mean, okay, they're all married to the same man there. I mean, Hagar wasn't exactly married to Avraham. But the idea that if a woman can't have a child and bringing another woman into the equation in order to be able to have a child, that idea really is very biblical. Mm.
So before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask you, we were speaking earlier and you mentioned that Mayim Chaim is developing some materials around fertility. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We are publishing a fertility journey healing guide that was created with support from the Miriam Fund, Boston area giving circle, basically. And Dahlia Davis, who is a co-founder of the Uprooted organization, was our author, and we worked with her to put together this guide. We know that people in the Jewish community tend to have babies later in life than in the general population, which means that there's a higher rate of fertility challenges, and just it makes it that much harder. And that typically people have really good access to medical care and are really keyed into that world, but there is not much of anything in the way of spiritual support and helping from a community basis, helping women and couples through this very difficult and challenging time. So we actually created a healing guide, Jewish healing guide for women with cancer. And this is a similar to that cancer healing guide for fertility. So that's available on the Mayim Chaim website, which is mayimchaim.org, to mayimchaim.org, and will be available for purchase. Will be a great resource.
Great. That sounds great. So for your blog, how can people find it if they want to read about
good
your
question.
Experience?
So the blog is called theresnoiinuterus.wordpress.com. And that also frames like how I was thinking about this. Like, this isn't, you know, we're all in this together.
And if other people are interested in, you know, finding out more about how to potentially follow in your footsteps, how would you recommend they get started with it?
I would recommend a couple things, lots of research and just learning about the process. There was a ton that I had no idea about by the time I was like on the phone with my doctor and she was like, you know, so you'll have injections for this. I was like, what? Huh? Like, I had no idea that there was any kind of anything involved like that. So just learn. And I'm happy. My contact information is on the blog. I'm totally happy to connect with anybody who might be thinking about this and want to have a conversation to see if, you know, if I can be helpful.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much for joining us. Thank you, Jamie, for your perspective.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This was great.
Thank you. This is wonderful.
Next up, the final word after this quick word from our sponsor.
Yeshivat Chovevei Torah is proud of its new class of 12 rabbis, which brings our total to 120 rabbis now serving Jewish communities. These modern Orthodox rabbis are making a difference in the United States, Europe, Australia, and Israel. If you think you have what it takes to be a Jewish leader and to be the next Chovevei Torah rabbi, come visit us and see what we're all about. For source sheets to accompany the Joy of Text episodes and for other great Torah, visit our Torah library at www.yctorah.org.
And now it's time for the final word. So this is an anonymous comment that came in, actually based on an older episode. Hey, I'm in the middle of the episode on tzniut, modesty. I wanted to say that I completely identify with Rabbi Dov Linzer's comment on tzniut being a force that brings you down and how that is problematic in the modern world. I feel that it is hard for me to talk about myself and my good qualities, and this is detrimental to interviews and even work environment. I think my religious upbringing had a strong focus on anava and tzniut, and this has been very bad for me. It causes me to be passive and shy. I love the show.
So I need to, it's much of, and I just want to say thank you so much for writing. And I hope that over the time of listening to the show, maybe you're starting to understand that there are different ways to understand things, that tzniut could mean other things rather than always putting yourself down. And maybe think about a little bit of therapy, because I think a therapeutic relationship may be helpful.
I think it's a real issue. It's really a challenge. It's really a challenge to strike the balance between tzniut in dress and not submerging your sexuality. And it's a challenge to figure out the right balance between tzniut in demeanor. So I think it's something that really requires serious thought, and I appreciate you raising it.
Well, thank you so much for that insightful note. And to all of our other listeners, we really love to hear from you with either your questions or your comments that we might feature in the final word. So please write in. You can do so anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org.
Keep sending them in, because we love getting them.
And keep listening. Thanks so much. Thank you to our guests, Carrie and Jamie Bornstein. This episode of The Joy of Text was recorded by Mike Hurst and produced and edited by me, Rebecca Honig-Friedman. If you have questions or comments you'd like to share with us, you can do so anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org or send us a regular email at joyoftextpodcast@gmail.com. The Joy of Text is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, or any podcast app. If you like what you hear, show your support by giving us a 5-star rating, and stay up to date with our latest episodes and live events by following us on Facebook or Twitter.